I'm Mary Atkins, and this is the story behind my stories.
You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise, Terry
Brooks, Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Mary Atkins.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories, the podcast where we bring you the story behind the stories and the storyteller. Author interviews, writing advice, book reviews, all sorts of great stuff. If you are a book lover, Author Stories is the place for you. We have more than 550 author interviews in our archives at HankGarner.com. Please go over there and check it out. Also, check out our YouTube channel, where we also have all of the episodes archived there. If you don't find an author interview that you're looking for on the website, click on the Archives tab. There's a long list of them where you can click and download and listen right there. I'd like to tell you about some sponsors that make the show possible. Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. Visit Crystal Pico Watanabe and her team of eight people who help her provide services to fiction authors. Crystal's full slate of services now include beta reading, manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors, you can also inquire about putting your books in her new Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. This is free for authors for a limited time. PicosHouse.com, that's PicosHouse.com, for all your book publishing needs. Devin Ford, Recon, the expansion series book. Hundreds of years in Earth's future sees the United Global Territories striving to colonize the Moon and Mars. The discovery of a clean energy source ended the world's reliance on fossil fuels overnight, and years after the resulting wars, a new discovery puts the tenuous world peace at risk, that of faster-than-light travel. With humanity on the verge of traveling to new solar systems and all the humanitarian and scientific possibilities involved, a discovery by the reconnaissance team turns everything upside down. Join the small team of the reconnaissance mission who fight friend and foe to complete their mission objectives, no matter where it leads them or what the personal cost. Devin Ford, Recon, the expansion series, book one. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, we have an exciting storyteller on the show with us today. Mary Atkins has a phenomenal new book that is out today. It's called When You Read This, and it is one of the most unique, funny, and really heart-wrenching yet I don't even know all the words I want for it. It's such a fun book, and it covers the emotional spectrum. And it's a really unique take on the epistolatory novel. And Mary, I'm excited to talk with you today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here.
So Mary, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, that's such a good question. Well, the one that's coming to mind is being in seventh grade English class. Miss Chansey was my teacher. She's my favorite teacher I've ever had. And we had a poetry unit, and she assigned us poems. We had to write poems in different styles, and one of them was haiku. And Austin Smith, who was in my class, who I'm still friends with, by the way. Hi, Austin, if you're listening. Austin Smith wrote a haiku called First Raindrop. That was the title of the haiku. And the first line of the haiku was Prelude to a Storm. And he read it out loud in class. And I was sitting there, and I remember just being overwhelmed with jealousy. Like, I wish I had written that line, because I thought it was so good. And I think that was like, I thought, wow, I really want to be good at writing. Like, I never had that about anything else before. I mean, I had you know, I wanted, you know, I did things as a kid. I danced and I tried to play basketball and stuff, but I didn't have that same, like, just really kind of craving in my gut like I did when I was envious of Austin Smith's haiku.
I love that. After the haiku ignition, when that kind of woke you up to that, did you start trying your hand at poetry, at haiku, at any kind of fiction? Like, I'm always intrigued by when that sort of awakening happens and then how people start to try to find their way, to pursue this thing that they have just newly discovered.
Yeah, I did. After that, I mean, I really dove into that assignment. We created a poetry notebook, I remember, and wrote different kinds of poems. And there was haiku and sonnet and freeform. And I remember being more proud of that poetry notebook than, I don't know, probably I'd been of anything. And so that was seventh grade. So I guess, I don't know, you're maybe 12, 13. And yeah. from then on, I wrote all the time. Like, I wrote for fun. Just, I would write stories. I would write poems. I would enter writing contests that I found, you know, in like teenage magazines. it really did. Ignition is a good word for it, because I do think it ignited that in me. And I never really stopped after that.
So, how do you, first off, were you a big reader, at that age?
Oh yeah. I've always loved reading. Yeah.
What were the kind of things that you loved?
Oh, I loved, Anne of Green Gables, The True Adventures of Charlotte Doyle, Encyclopedia Brown, The Mixed Up Files of Miss Basil E. Frankweiler. I'm just remembering all of these books that just totally took me away as a kid. Island of the Blue Dolphin, Scott Odell's books, I loved.
You've mentioned some classics and some that we consider classics, Anna Green Gables and things like that. And then there are classics from my growing up, like Encyclopedia Brown. Those are, that's, you know, high literature that should be respected. These are some great examples of storytelling that have lasted, some of them, you know, over 100 years, and some of them that we just have fond memories of our childhood. You teach storytelling. What is it that about those stories do you think that still resonate with us, even though we are, far separated from the subject matter? The world has changed very differently, but these are still stories you can mention and people will smile and get a warm feeling about, from a storytelling standpoint. What do you think it is about those that resonate and last?
That's such a good question. I think for me, when I think about what is a story that really kind of gets to my heart and sticks with me, I think it comes down to vulnerability, like the vulnerability of the hero or the heroine, like really believing that they are in a place where they have a lot to lose, and really, you know, being able to be with them in that moment and just feeling the desperation that they feel not to lose whatever it is, you know, that matters to them. And I think in teaching storytelling, I occasionally will hear stories in workshops where I think people really are able to tap into that, and they tell the most beautiful stories. And these aren't often people who consider themselves storytellers, and certainly not writers a lot of times, but they, by being willing to go to that vulnerable place of sharing something that they really cared about that was at risk. I think it's just like, I don't know if it's, you know, human nature. I don't know if it seems like it is sort of inbred in us or something, like inborn in us. I mean, the ability to empathize with someone when they're really telling a good story, you know?
You were raised in the American South, right?
Yes. And you're from the South.
I am from the South. My accent betrays me sometimes. what part exactly were you from?
a little bit all over. So I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and then we moved to Nashville. And then this was all in my toddler years, so I don't actually remember it. And then we moved to Augusta, Georgia, and I lived there for a while. And then we moved to Greenville, South Carolina. And mostly I grew up in South Carolina. But my grandparents are in Louisiana. I have family in Texas and Virginia. So we're kind of all over the South.
Right, right. Just sprinkled all around. Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel like that certain pieces of geography, or maybe it's the culture there, I don't know what it is, but do you feel like certain places or people groups are more inclined to storytelling? Do you notice those things?
You know, it's so interesting. I know that my grandfather tells really good stories and always has. And they're always sprinkled with jokes, you know, and it's almost kind of like, it's like an art form almost. Like he tells the same, you know, they're kind of the same stories. You can tell that they're crafted over time and they kind of, you know, like the oral history type of thing. They're true stories from his life. I know that's a big Southern thing, but I've also noticed, you know, I've lived outside of the South now for, I don't know, since I was 22. So I'm dating myself like 15 years or so. And, I noticed living in the Northeast, there's this in the communities where, you know, people have stayed in the same place for generations. I do think there's the same kind of tradition of storytelling. So maybe it has something to do with passing down culture and people kind of staying in a place that really lends itself to like actually sitting down and swapping stories. I don't know.
I really like that answer. I was hoping you were going to go somewhere like that because I think I've had the same experience of meeting lots and lots and lots of people. Is that it's to me, it's not necessarily a geography thing. It's a community thing. When you get to places where people gather around and actually take the time to communicate with each other, kind of one of our default settings of storytelling. And maybe the South with its, you know, with our hot summers and people would congregate on front porches and things like that. You know, that's a conduit for that. But maybe in the, in the New England states, in the Northeast, maybe that's around, you know, the fishing docks or something like that. But I think it's more of a community thing than a geography thing.
Yeah, I love that. And one thing I noticed, we'd sit outside growing up. I mean, in South Carolina, we sat on my screen porch like every day after school. That's just what we did with my parents. And we'd sit there at night. And I noticed I've lived in Queens now for, when I moved in Queens in 2013, so 5 years. And I noticed the same thing. The people who have, are sort of staples of the community, they'll sit out on their stoops. You know, in the same way, it's the same thing.
That's really cool. Because as a storyteller does, pursued a law degree, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And I actually got it.
Nice, nice. So tell me about that. You've got this kid who's on fire to write. And of course you go to law school. What was that decision like for you?
I think it was both like a reactionary decision and a proactive decision. And on one hand, it was like, it's hard to be a writer, you know? I mean, so, a year out of college, I was bartending and trying to write. And I thought, this is really hard. What can I do that's a little safer? Law school. And so I think there was there's a self-preservation streak, you know, kind of just career ambitious streak there. But also I am really interested in law. I always have been. I think it's, I loved law school. I actually loved studying the law and like kind of, you know, the structures around how we are allowed to live our lives. I think it's really interesting and important. And so I've always been drawn to that intellectually. Like I majored in public policy in college for the same reason. I just really like it as a subject. And so, I think I'd always kind of been pulled in those two directions. There was the creative pull, and there was also this pull of getting involved in policy and understanding law. and maybe trying to make a difference in the world that way. And so I think at different times in my life, well, throughout my 20s, I kind of tried to focus on one over the other. And I kind of ended up sort of not being sure which direction I wanted to go for a few years. But then I graduated from law school and I only practiced law for 7 months, and that was long enough for me to know I did not actually want to be a lawyer. I love studying law, but I didn't want to be a lawyer. So I left that job and really committed myself to making it work, being a writer at that point.
Because I really love the intersection of things and how we are influenced by things that seem odd for what we wind up doing. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your time studying law and practicing law for when you did, do you feel like that those experiences influenced you as a storyteller? Did they give you any tools that you can now look back on and say, I'm glad I had that experience because now I can X, Y, or Z?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yeah, I think, it's funny because for me, I don't know if this is true for everyone, but for me, in terms of how I look at the world and understand the world, I think the law is always kind of in the background. Like, how is the law shaping what's happening right now? I think that was always a question on my mind. And so now having gone to law school and kind of, trained up on how the law works, even though I would definitely wouldn't call myself I haven't been practicing in 7 years. So I'm not an expert in the law by any means, but having, spent some time training in the law, I think it does shape how I see what's happening to people. And by people, I mean my characters. So it does. It's kind of, I don't know. I think it is maybe always sort of in the background of, even if it's not, literally in what I'm, or explicitly in what I'm writing or working on, I think it's kind of back there in the back of my head.
I have not studied law. I have never, been down that path, but I would think that one of the things that makes a great law student is not that you learn everything that you ever need to know about the law, but you learn how to learn and learn how to research things and know where to get your hands on things and how to think through things. I would think those are great skills for a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love that, actually. That's probably true. And I hadn't realized it. Like, those years spent really honing my research skills probably empowered me to do that when it comes to working on fiction. I also think there's a tendency, I'm now working on my second novel and recently got editorial notes from my editor back on it. And the law is more present in that novel than it is in my first novel. And there's, one particular part where it really gets into the nitty gritty of a case. And her feedback was, you're giving us way too much legal stuff here. So I think I have a tendency to try to, I'm like, but I need to be accurate. So I'm going to include all of the legal documents. And she's like, this is too much. Like, they don't need to read this much legalese.
That's so funny. So when you said you were going to focus on writing, that practicing law was not for you, what did you start doing? How do you start kind of carving out your niche?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the first thing I tried to do was write a memoir. It was called All the Homeless People Can Live in My Room. And it was, subtitle. The subtitle was My Life Making a Mess, Trying to Make a Difference. And it was just sort of like a comedic memoir, kind of. I don't know if you ever knew the book Hypocrite in a White Poofy Dress. It was a little bit like that book.
Gotcha.
And so I wrote that proposal up, and that took me about 6 months or so. And I was pitching it to agents, and I got a few agents who were interested in it. And then finally, one of them really nicely told me, this kind of book is not selling right now. You need to write something else. And he said, actually, his words were, I could have sold the hell out of this in the 90s, but I can't sell this now. Which was like very direct. And I appreciate it. And so I, at that point, I ended up in a little email exchange with them. And I said, well, what can you sell? Ha ha, you know. And he said, I don't know, what else interests you to write? And it was actually that question that kind of spawned me to think, well, like, could I write a novel? Like, I'd never really, it's not that I didn't think I could write a novel, but I kind of think I didn't think I could write a novel. Like, it never occurred to me that I could do that. But I had started to sort of have an idea for a novel. And I said, well, here's this idea I'm having for a novel. What do you think? And he wrote back and he said, ooh, I love it. Go, write that novel and then email me. Nice. And basically that was what did it. I thought, well, he said, if I write this novel, I can email him. He did not end up being my agent, but I am still really grateful for that conversation because, I think it's really what kind of gave me the impetus to write the first draft of my first novel, which eventually became When You Read This.
Which is out everywhere today.
Yes.
So tell us that, you know, the spark came from that conversation, but how did the story itself start unfolding? Did you get a character? Did you get a setting? Was it some literary device? What was that initial spark?
Yeah, the first spark was a character. It was the character of Iris. I was, at that time, I was 20, let's see, what was I? 28, I think. And I had recently left law. I had just quit my job, literally just quit my job, was kind of freelancing, finding, I was tutoring to pay the bills and trying to find some more freelance work. I had moved to a much cheaper apartment, farther out in Brooklyn. And I was just trying to write. And so I actually felt like for the first time in my life, my life is starting. Like, this is my life starting. Like, everything up till now has been getting me ready for now. And now I know I'm on the right path. I'm doing what I'm meant to do. And so with that, though, came this kind of, I guess, a morbid version of the same idea, which was, what if something happened to me now? That'd be terrible. Like, what if that was all I had? And so that question kind of tormented me so much because I felt like I was just at the beginning of my life, that I really felt like I needed to process that. And I wanted to try to do that through fiction. So I decided to try to process that question through my character, Iris, who is the protagonist of When You Read This. So she is 33 and she finds out that she has 6 months to live and she is in that same place. She feels like she thought her life hadn't started yet. And now it turns out that was her life. And so she has in the novel, when it opens, she has 6 months to come to terms with that reality.
Wow. So what was the idea for making it an epistolatory novel? And then how did this kind of new take on an epistolatory novel take shape?
Well, I wanted Iris's blog was the first thing I wrote. I knew that I wanted it to be a blog because I wanted it to be in her voice and I wanted her to be talking into the ether. Cause I was really fascinated. I'm still fascinated with kind of how we relate to people over the internet and how we can sometimes turn to the internet when we don't feel ready to turn to people that we really, you know, quote unquote, really know or know physically in our other lives. And I really liked that dynamic of how we can be honest online sometimes in ways we can't not online. And so I wrote her blog first and then, it felt really sad. and so I wanted to add some context. I love humor in literature and I wanted to it wasn't just that it was really sad. It was also that I wanted to explore how people reading her blog were impacted by it. And so I decided to write a story around the discovery of her blog after she had gone. Now, that was not originally in the format it eventually took. It was actually narrated at first. And I eventually, I think several drafts in, decided it wasn't quite working. Like the narrating the story of Smith, her boss, who discovers her blog in the book, narrating his discovery of the blog was, I don't know, not quite popping for me the way I wanted it to. And so it just kind of, I remember one day it kind of hit me like, what if I took on the challenge of telling the story totally through emails, like Smith discovering Iris's blog after she's gone and having to communicate with her sister. What if I just told the story through emails? And it was a serendipitous, serendipitous timing, because I had just been offered, there was a writing residency at the Noepe Center, which is in, or was in Martha's Vineyard. It's since closed its doors, sadly, but they, a spot had opened up at this residency just last minute. And someone had emailed me and said, do you want this spot? It's you can come here for a couple weeks and, you get to stay in this, you know, little house with a bunch of writers. And, I think it was a week or two away. And I just decided to take on this new challenge of redrafting my novel and wrote back like, yes, I want to do it. So I went there with this purpose of, I'm going to tell this whole story through emails. And at that residency was where I took the first stab at that. I left with a very rough draft, but a draft of the story in email format.
The Locus, books 1-3 by Ralph Kern. The Complete Locus Series, an epic tale of mystery, survival, exploration, intrigue. The cruise ship MS Atlantica is lost on these strange and uncharted seas, where even the compass shows the sun rising to the west. Atlantica's passengers must do what it takes to survive. The three books, Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Atlantica arrives in a strange new world, unable to locate land and with no way to contact home. They must find new allies, fend off relentless enemies, and discover the horrifying truth behind the Locus. The Locus box set contains all three action-packed novels in this best-selling science book. Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Acclaimed for great characters, thrilling action, technical accuracy, and a compelling sense of mystery. Buy it today from Ralph Kern, The Locus. The Renegade Star Series, books 1-3 from J.N. Chaney. Jace Hughes is a renegade. That means taking almost any job that comes his way, no matter the situation. So long as he can keep his ship floating, he's free to live the life he wants. But that all changes when he meets Abigail Pryor, a nun looking for safe passage out of the system. Too bad there's something off about the cargo she's carrying. Jace knows he shouldn't ask too many questions, but when odd sounds start coming from inside the large metal box, he can't help but check it. Big mistake. The Renegade Star box set includes the first three books in the series, 900-plus pages, 300-plus five-star reviews. Find out why people are so intrigued by this thrilling science fiction epic. You won't believe the twists and turns the series takes, or the secrets they get. The Renegade Star series, get the entire box set on Amazon, or audiobook from audible.com. There's links to it in the show notes.
As you are going through the draft and, you know, your perspective changes from that original narrator to, you know, the blog post and emails and all of this stuff as the narrative starts to take shape. Were there, times where you're like, this is just isn't working. Maybe I can, maybe this could be told better from this perspective. Is that where, kind of the difference in the blog post and the emails and the text come in? I guess what I'm asking is that those are kind of different tools in your toolbox as a writer. What did each of those or the difference in those give you the ability to do as far as moving the story?
Yeah, that's a good question. That was a fun thing to explore, actually, because you're right. There would be situations where, so for example, I would think, well, you know, I want Jade, the sister, to share with us about what's going on in her internal life. Like, I really want her to unload. And I don't think she would do that in an email to someone right now in her life. What is some kind of form that exists online that would, or forum even, that would allow her to really unload in the way that I think we need her to as the reader, that feels authentic. And that's how I came up with this idea of, the therapist away network. So Jade is in therapy, but her therapist is hiking Machu Picchu on his 70th birthday. And so he has hooked her up with this online therapy platform for when a therapist leaves town, where she can just vent online and then he responds as he can. It turns out, you know, now there's this company, I think it's called Talkspace, where this actually exists. It's like a form of written online therapy. But when I came up with this, I don't think that existed yet. So that was a solution to finding a way for her to share her story in a way that felt authentic. And same thing with some of the, you know, eventually a couple of the characters start texting. And for that, I tried to, you know, be true to my experience of how people of my generation, I'm kind of the same age and generation as the people in the book, how I feel like relationships have sort of evolved to be, you know, you kind of start with email if it's professional. And then at some point, if you get close enough, maybe you'll migrate to text, you know? I mean, I'm pretty sure that's not how younger people do it now. I think maybe they just jump straight to text. But yeah, that felt okay for these characters to me.
Gotcha. The book is, like I tried to, explain earlier, it really deals with some deep stuff. But at the same time is incredibly funny and kind of self-deprecating in a lot of places. Is that important for you to balance out the dark and serious with humor? And, I know, you know, as a writer, sometimes for my own benefit, I have to, kind of bring some levity in because things just get, you know, way too serious. And I know that readers are the same way. We kind of have to let them off the hook every now and then and allow them to take a breath. And then having those high points maybe makes those more serious ones resonate more. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I love that way of putting it, like having that, letting them off the hook and letting them take a breath. Yeah, I completely agree. And it was important to me. It is important to me to have humor as part of a story. And it's not just, I think it's what you're saying. I think it's for the reader's benefit, but it's also, I think, for me, more true to life that even in the darkest times, there are sort of these absurd, hilarious things that can happen. So like no moment is purely darkness, you know, I mean, maybe it is, but it's fleeting. At some point you're going to laugh. I had this experience like, right around the time I think I was first starting to work on the novel, I was going through a breakup and I was so devastated by it. And I remember I was sitting on my couch in my apartment, just sobbing, like just, you know, ugly crying, just weeping. And my computer was on my coffee table, so it was in front of me, so I could see emails coming in, but I wasn't paying attention to my computer because I was crying. But then I saw this email come in. And I think it was from work or something. And so I'm like, oh, I should click on it. So I kind of stopped crying for a minute and clicked on it. And it was from a colleague. And it was like something funny or something from work that was, so I don't even remember what the content was, but I remember it was funny. And so I laughed and it was like, oh, I'm laughing. How did I just go from crying to laughing that fast? And then I kind of closed the email and went back to being sad again. But it was like this funny experience of realizing how we can, you know, we can really as humans, we can shift very quickly between emotions.
Right, right. And sometimes it's gallows humor, you know, there's just, it's our natural, you know, the part of the human condition to try to, I don't know, put things in perspective to, but anyway, you handle it deftly in the book and I really love it. Like I mentioned earlier, you teach storytelling and you also have a new podcast, don't you?
I do. Yes. We launched a couple of weeks ago, actually.
Nice. Nice. What did those two things, teaching storytelling and then maybe the new venue of podcasting, how do those help you, kind of hit all of the notes, of your creativity? Mm-hmm. You know, how do they, as a creative person, what do those things feed in you?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I love both on the podcast where my co-host and I interview artists who are parents. So it's about making art once you have kids. Both with that and with teaching storytelling, where I'm working with people on crafting and telling their own stories. It's collaborative, so I get to hear stories of other people, and that really fulfills a part of me that it's hard to fill that part with writing fiction, because writing novels is a very, solitary experience. So while, I mean, I guess I'm with my characters, but they're in my head. So in that sense, I do think it's a really nice, I'm very grateful that I get to teach storytelling. And I'm enjoying podcasting for the same reason. I get to talk to other creative people and kind of be fed in that way by hearing other people's stories, instead of, you know, really just focusing on what's coming from within. Although I enjoy that too. It's just, you know, it's such a different, it's like kind of, they're two sides of the same coin or something.
Right. I have 5 kids. I really could have used your podcast 10 years ago. Yeah. 10 years ago, that would have made a huge impact in my life. But whatever, you chose to wait. So, you know, we'll just do it again. Mary, this has been so much fun talking. The new book, it's called, I'm sorry, excuse me. It's called When You Read This, is out everywhere today. I'll edit out the cough. Also, your podcast is called I'm Still Here. Is there a place online, and I'll link both of those in the show notes, of course, but is there a place online where if people want to learn more about you and really get into what you do, is there a place where they can read more about you and maybe connect with you?
Yeah, my website is my name, Mary Adkins with a D, not a T, not like the diet, MaryAdkins.net. And on Instagram, I don't use Twitter too much, but I love Instagram. I am Adkins Mary, just my name flipped.
Instagram's where all the good vibes are.
Yeah,
right. For sure.
All the happy photos.
That's right. Well, I'll link it all up. Mary, I absolutely love what you're doing. We're going to send everybody to pick up their copy of When You Read This. And I wish you much success on the launch today.
Thanks so much, Hank. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. Find all the archives at hankgarner.com. Now, stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
Midnight struck. The Sandman had come. A few faint notes drifted through the rooms of 417 Gorybrook. The hollow wind testing the weatherproofing, the weak scritch of the persimmon tree against Zeph's window, and the drone of Hedwig's snoring. The old house shifted, creaked, and the shade of Agatha Van Brunt descended from the attic.
"Brahm?" she called.
The ghost paused, collecting herself on the stair. She passed a mirror, but the glass remained empty, reflecting only absence. Agatha would not have recognized herself anyway. She had been beautiful long ago, and still was in her own mind. Not a toothless and wizened specter. Not a blue chalk sketch of a hag half erased from the blackboard of night. She drifted into the master bedroom, disappeared into a shaft of moonbeams, and reappeared on the other side. She stood over Hedwig, listening to him snore. But Hedwig was not Brahm. She needed Brahm. She slipped through the floor into Zeph's bedroom. She stood over him for a long time, listening to the persimmon tree's weak coffin scratch on the window screen.
Brahm?
No, this was not Brahm. Not Brahm, her son. But she loved this boy. So much hidden potential. He reminded her of Dylan, her grandson. Dylan had slept in this room many, many times. But Dylan was dead, never to return. This boy, Zeph, was alive. So alive.
Oh, would that he might remain so forever. Look at him. Who would consign such a handsome lad to the rot of death? Only a very cruel and blind god.
Agatha brushed her spectral lips to Zeph's cheek. He stirred, scratched the spot, and rolled into his pillow. But Zeph was not Brahm. Where?
Oh, Brahm is dead.
She remembered now.
Brahm is dead, and so are Hermanus, my husband, and Hans, my brother, and old Baltus Van Tassel, and Katrina, all dead. Only old Agatha remains, after a fashion, to trouble the world.
Her sense of herself sharpened and returned to her. She searched the rooms for the crane boy. She sensed him. Yes. Here was the boy, sleeping fitfully, holding his animal. She extended a hand as if to reach into Jason's chest and take his heart in her talons. The dog woke, sensing Agatha's presence, and growled.
Growl till your voice cracks, cur. I could kill this child myself. I could possess the man or the boy. I could take the butcher knife from the drawer. I could stride through the night in strong male form and dissect this child at my whim.
Something struck her. Something blasted her up and away from the boy. She collected her energies again and tried to re-enter, but could not pass through the walls. When she found her voice, it came as hollow and cold as wind through a tomb.
Who is here?
Agatha whispered, and her tone might have withered grass.
Show yourself.
She waited with growing confusion and anxiety. She threw herself forward and battered the door like a tempest.
Who is here?
She cried. But no one answered.